a look back on a Haitian folk hero, and a new way of looking at public art. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Joseph Emmanuel Chalmai, also known as Mano Chalmai, passed away recently. His name may not be well known outside of the Haitian community, but he's been compared to Bob Marley because of his politically and socially powerful lyrics. We take a look back at the life and music of Mano Chalmai. Ruth Barodi is the youngest artist ever to receive a public art commission from Broward County. She joins us to talk about her current project. She's creating art around the county with a very unusual canvas, traffic signal boxes. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, this past Sunday, a Haitian folk hero passed away. Joseph Emmanuel Mano Chalmai was exiled from his home country years ago. He always vowed to return and did briefly, even to become mayor of Port-au-Prince. He lived out his life, though, performing in places in Miami and Miami Beach. I recently spoke with WLRN reporter Nadege Green about Chalmai's role and influence within the Haitian community. So, Nadege, when I say the name Mano Chalmai, what are some of the ideas and feelings and images that come to mind?
Definitely resistance. Someone who was almost like the conscience of a country, right? His music spoke to all of the underlying issues in Haiti, injustices that were happening at the time. He addressed politics. He addressed political corruption. And he addressed the quality of life for everyday people. When we talk about the 1% versus everyone else, like that was the story he told.
Is it something that if I go into the Haitian community, everybody knows who he is? Everybody's heard of him. They can recite a song or they know something about him?
I think it depends on the age of the person. For sure, like my parents' generation, Probably. I think for younger Haitians like myself, people maybe in their 30s or younger, it would really depend. Some of my friends, like I know after Mano Chalmai died, knew exactly who he was. And, you know, some of my Haitian American friends who were born here in Miami had heard of him in passing, but really didn't know much about who he was or what his legacy was in the Haitian community. So I think for like first generation Haitians who were born here in the U.S., maybe his story doesn't resonate the same because they don't know his story, unless maybe in your home, like in my household, your parents played his music or talked about history or, you know, what was happening in Haiti. You may not know who he is.
So I read somewhere that he was like a Bob Marley type figure, you know, and I can understand if, you know, he's writing a lot about political issues and social issues, but is that a fair comparison?
I think so. I mean, you know, Bob Marley is the Bob Marley of Jamaica. Mano Chalmai is the Mano Chalmai of Haiti, right? I think the messaging, though, there are some parallels there about, you know, talking about the voices of the people, right? You know, it's a people-centered movement and talking about how, you know, the outcomes of government, how, you know, the outcomes of political structures impact the everyday man. That definitely is the underlying tones of much of what he spoke about.
But he didn't become this international figure like Bob Marley. Do you think it mattered to him or anybody else?
I don't know. I can't speak to, you know, what he thought, you know, as far as where he thought he would go in the music world. But, you know, I think that's just a challenge in general for Haitian musicians because of the language barrier, because it's in Creole. And so there has not been a lot of crossover appeal, more so now, I think. But in his time, that like predates the internet, that predates social media and predates like, you know, really world music, you know, catapulting into the national or international stage, that just didn't really happen. And on top of that, you have the language barrier so that people may not know what he's saying. You know, some people describe his music as romantic, hearing the melodies, but don't know the words, right? Because his music can, if you knew the words, perhaps it's more haunting than romantic what he is saying.
Is there one song that stands out that you think about?
So one of my favorite songs, and it's one of my favorite songs because my dad used to play this as well, is Bomyo Tilimye. It's like, give me a little light, is roughly what it translates to in English. But in this song, he asks a series of questions. He asks why, you know, why does the average man have to suffer? You know, why is life so sweet for some, but not everyone has that privilege? You live, you die, and you suffer. You know, he's telling again the story of everyday man in Haiti, right? The suffering.
Bom yo tirimie pou mwen sa ka pase. Bom yo tirimie men. Bom yo tirimie souple pou mta we. Pou ki sa senèg yo fè soufri. Pou ki sa senèg yo fè so. Pou ki sa neg baga manje.
I mean, Manoj Almai, his music really resonated among the generation of Haitians who were in Haiti under Jean-Claude Duvalier, right? This is under a dictatorship. And he spoke about that. He spoke about, you know, the militias in Haiti and things of that nature. And in fact, his music was considered protest music. And if you listened to his music back then, if you were one of the young people listening to that music, sometimes the perception would be that you are a rebel, right? That you are one of them, you're anti-government. And so there was this level of persecution, right, that came with, you know, embracing this music because it was also considered very anti-government and anti-establishment.
And again, we're hearing from WLRN's Nadege Green telling us about the life of Joseph Emmanuel Mano Chalamai. He is the Haitian singer known for his powerful political and social lyrics. He died of cancer this past Sunday. He was 69. We'll hear more about Chalamai's life and music after this message to listeners, because, again, a reminder, it is our membership campaign and we need your support. By the way, we're almost done with this campaign, but let me turn it over to the pros to tell you how to do it. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, recently I spoke with WLRN's Nadege Green about the late Haitian singer-songwriter Joseph Emmanuel Mano Chalamai. He died over the weekend of cancer. Chalamai's music often sounded like love songs, but his lyrics in Creole were scathing, usually about Haiti's leaders, especially the Duvaliers. He grew up in Port-au-Prince, where he became an activist as well as a musician, and he was arrested and detained a number of times. That's one reason he spent most of his later years living and performing in Miami Beach. Let's return.
There was a story that was produced by former WLRN reporter Kenny Malone, and there's an excerpt that was quite revealing.
Even though Florida hosts the largest Haitian-American population in the country, and Tap Tap Restaurant boasts some of the best Haitian cuisine in South Florida, most of the customers at the South Beach restaurant aren't Haitian.
They do enjoy the music, but they just don't know this man's history.
General manager Gary Sananjul says mostly it's locals, tourists, and some regulars.
I had a friend of mine who came in one time and listened to Mano, and she thought that he was just singing about the most romantic thing.
Every Thursday and Saturday at 8:30 sharp, you can find Charlemagne here, hunched over a nylon string guitar, crooning in Creole into a dented microphone.
The fact that he was performing for tourists, does that do anything to his legacy, considering, again, what he stood for?
I don't think it does anything to his legacy. I think his legacy is what it is. You know, I think it doesn't discount his legacy at all. I think he was a musician till the very end, and he had a message to tell till the very end. And it may be, you know, at Tap Tap, where he would perform on Miami Beach, I think the only Haitian restaurant on Miami Beach, tourists may not understand what he was saying, but this is who he was, right? This is every fiber of his being, and he did that, you know, that's what he did.
He passed away recently. He was 69 years old, passed away of cancer. Does his death kind of get people to talk again about who he was, what he meant? Does it maybe help to open up a conversation about, you know, his music?
Absolutely. I mean, on social media, I have been watching it play out, and it's very interesting because new people are learning about him right now, right? In his passing, I've seen so many posts, both en Creole and in English and in French, from across, like people in Canada, whether you're in Boston, whether you're in, you know, Paris, who are talking about the legacy of who this man was. And so perhaps if you didn't know who Manoj Chalmai was, if you never had any experience with his music, you would look it up, right? Or you're playing the YouTube clips that everyone are posting. And so his message is still living on and people are hearing it, sometimes for the first time. And that's okay, right? But this is who he was. And his message, I think, definitely is playing out a lot more now in his death because everyone is talking about him. Everyone is talking about his music. You know, someone, I saw a poem dedicated to him recently in Creole that pretty much called him the conscience of the community. Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, even acknowledged, you know, this patriot to our country. I don't know that past political figures in Haiti may necessarily, you know, recall him in such a positive light because he was known for going after some political figures. But I think resolutely, like, overall, people look back at who he was and the voice that he had in the community and what that meant, even though maybe he didn't, you know, become this international superstar that he could have become. But, you know, oftentimes when you're creating music or movements around resistance, that is not always embraced, you know, in a commercial way that says, you know, everyone wants to take part of this because it was very much, you know, combative in some ways. And it was very raw. And perhaps now more folks will hear his music and maybe reflect on what that meant and what his words meant then and what they mean in the context of today.
Are there any artists or singers right now that are kind of carrying on that mantle?
I don't know who the next Manoj Chalmai is in the Haitian community or in the Haitian music scene. I think there's only one Mano, you know. There are amazing young artists, obviously, coming through the Haitian music scene. One of my favorite is Bello, for example. But, you know, there's just only one Mano in the same way that you're like, who's the next Bob Marley? There's only one Bob Marley, right? You can't recreate that.
And again, that was WLRN's Nadej Green talking about the life of Joseph Emmanuel Manoj Chalmai. We're hearing a little bit of his music. He passed away Sunday in Miami Beach. He died of cancer. He was 69 years old. Chalmai's family is holding a public viewing today from 5:30 to 7 at Notre Dame de Haiti Catholic Church on Northeast 62nd Street. And the Mass is going to be at 7:30. More on his life on our website, WLRN.org. Coming up next, creating art in the most unlikely places. That's Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, here in South Florida, we're surrounded by a lot of great art on the street. Tourists flock to see the murals in the Wynwood Walls. But on the streets all over our region, there's art by famous and not yet famous artists. And one of those youngest ones, our next guest, Ruth Barotti. She's a freshman at Broward College, and she's the youngest artist to receive a public art commission from Broward County. You're going to start seeing her art in a lot of places. Ruth, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming in.
Hi, thank you for having me.
When did you start painting murals?
Last year, actually. I was still in college. It was when I just started, and after I met with Grace from the Broward Cultural Division, she actually introduced me to Miss Peaches, Marie Huntley, of Graphitize Not Vandalize on Con Leadership. And she had like a little organization going on where they wanted to create public art and public murals. And also it was a thing where if you're a young person who has like a felony just for like doing vandalization, common things like that, you can actually join the program and get volunteer hours just by doing public art, just by doing what you love. Because it's really ridiculous that you could just, you know, you vandalize something and you're just pretty much an innocent young person just doing a mistake. But it's actually like a really good program where you can just a young person to be in. So I was one of the early people to be involved in it. And my first mural was down the street from Dillard High School, where it was pretty much a corner where it's called Debt's Corner.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Why is it called that?
Basically, it was because there's like a lot of accidents that happen. I remember when we were first starting and I had to go see what the walls looked like, a car accident had just happened right when I was right there.
Wow. Now, one of the things, too, in putting this together, and this is something else that you do with your art, is you bring the community into it. They get involved.
Yeah.
How do you do that? What do you do exactly?
Actually, it's just something that's pretty unplanned because all the stuff is, like, out there in the community in public, and I would do it, like, bright in broad daylight. Most of the kids and people who would walk by are interested in seeing what I'm doing, and sometimes I would get, like, feedback depending what the message is. Like, sometimes they're like, oh, we don't really want that here, but they haven't seen the finished work yet. But then the kids, there's something different. They as long as they see some paint, they always want to see do something with it.
So as people are walking by and they see you working, you invite them to actually tell you more about what they're seeing and what they think and maybe even give you ideas?
Yeah.
And you know what? Give me an example of like one time somebody came up and you started talking to them and they told you something about, what about this or maybe do that or I don't know. They gave you advice.
A kid actually came up one time when I was doing one of the murals. It was like he just got out of school. And what happened is that he's seen me paint like a mural where it's like a gun that's rusted and there's like grass and vines and flowers growing out of it, trying to symbolize taking out the violence right from the roots. And he was also having like this idea of like, oh, it should actually be like a frame instead of just one part. It should be like the whole wall. And he actually left and said, okay, I'm going to go ask my mom if I could paint. And by the time he came back, he brought like 10 other of these other kids. And I was like, whoa.
How did that project turn out?
It was actually pretty fun. They all were interested in like painting. I had to show them like certain techniques with the brush, how like what areas to paint. And since not all of them were like as tall as me, they can only go like around the height of the mural itself. So they actually, because of them, because they helped me out so much, I actually got all of it done in like a day.
I was about to say, how long did it take you? A day? That's for a mural. That's kind of impressive.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive. When did you start drawing, painting? When did you get into art?
I was in art for like a really long time since I was very little. I always would draw things I would see on TV, like cartoons, things I would wake up to see Saturday morning. And after a while in middle school, I was taking my art like a little more seriously. I joined the art club. I was actually the president for a little bit. And when I got into high school, I found out they have like these art magnet programs. So that's pretty much where I first auditioned for art and decided to take it as like a more career step towards it. And after high school, I was doing like experimenting with all the painting. I did pottery for a little bit. I drew a lot. I made comics. It's just things I was interested in. And when I got into college, things got really, really serious without me even knowing it. Because in high school, I was doing shows around Fort Lauderdale, being in the art program. It helped me connect with some really cool people, with my teacher connecting with like people who actually own studios in Fort Lauderdale area. I actually exhibited during art walks, and I sometimes came out during the weekends just to showcase and sell my art just to get myself out there. So I guess art was pretty taken seriously throughout all my life.
I wondered for you, how different is it, and what are some of the challenges when you're painting a mural compared to when you're painting, whether it's in your notepad or on a canvas, you're going from something usually small to now this bigger project. What are some of the challenges for you when you do that?
The challenges is pretty much a change of like the size itself. I was so used to drawing in like a sketchbook, and for a while, the biggest I drew was like a big canvas, not as just as big as my chest. But to go into murals, it was a game changer. I had to sketch up my idea. I actually had to get like a marker just to mark up the walls, make sure the sizes are right. But it wasn't as hard as I thought it would be. I guess the hardest thing is getting on the ladder and painting itself.
Do you have, I'd imagine you've gone around, whether it's in Broward County or Miami-Dade, you've seen some of the public art, the arts on the walls and, you know, like in the Wynwood walls and some of those other places, right?
Yes, I love it so much.
Is there any one piece that you've seen or is there an artist that you really admire?
An artist I really admire. One artist I admire a lot is someone who wasn't really a Miami artist. It's someone like from New York. I admire Cause. He started out as a graffiti artist and as like a skateboarder like me. He was just like a young kid doing like all these cool stuff. And after a while, he started being more experimental with painting, being a background artist in animation. I'm trying to be an animator right now. And I also love, like, a lot of murals around Wynwood. It makes me really envious because I feel like I'm not doing enough murals.
Let me ask you about the new commission with Broward County. Again, the youngest artist to receive a public arts commission, right?
Yeah.
How did that happen? Is that something that you had to apply to, or did they just call you up one day? Congratulations.
It was kind of like both. What happened is that when I was still in high school, I made a portfolio called Fight Like a Girl series. And after I exhibited it out for like a little bit, the director of Old Dillard Museum saw my work in social media and found out I did it. So he contacted the school. He found out I was still in Dillard. He contacted the school and they had like a little solo art exhibition just for my work. And that's where I met Grace. And what happened is after a while, I get called up saying, we want you to apply for this call for the artists for the traffic cabinets. And I was like, okay. And I applied. They interviewed me. I showed them my... Luckily, at the same time, I was doing murals, so I actually had experience in public art already. So a lot of things had worked out. So after I interviewed and showed them all my work, they decided, congratulations, you got the commission.
All right, so now you get this commission, and what's the project? You're going to different parts of unincorporated Broward County, right, to paint on these traffic signal boxes.
Kind of unincorporated. They're pretty condensed populations of Broward. They're in the BMSD Central County community, mm-hmm. and most of them are in corners of like high population of people walking, cars always driving by, things where people can easily see them. And they're not so much of me painting on them. I have a vendor to print my... I actually designed them myself. I'm a digital artist, so I design things on my tablet. And what happens is that I would send it to the vendor, and the vendor would go install them for me.
Wow. So you already have your designs for these boxes, right?
Yes. It's interesting because this past Monday, I actually been approved. The designs has mostly been approved for it. So in the next few weeks, we're going to be ready to install them.
Can you give me just an idea of what some of those designs are going to be?
One of the designs is of musicians. It pretty much celebrates how like black arts and black musicians around the community, because kids around the community like music. They love drawing. And Broward County has like a lot of artists, and it's pretty already into the arts already. So it was something to celebrate that. Another thing is, another one of the designs is one with I show like these shoes walking on like a pavement. But what happened is that I would draw them in such an exaggerated way with like these bright colors. Like, yeah, it's just people walking, but I do it in like out of the ordinary. It makes you like appreciate it. It's supposed to inspire people to go out more. It's like, and I named like the whole project itself Urban Treasures, because even though these things are in the sidewalk and you're just walking, not expecting anything, it could be something special that you would see down the street.
When are you going to start?
When am I going to start the installation?
Yeah.
I'm hoping the next 2 weeks. After it was been approved, they just want me to do like at least one change to them. And after that, I should get in touch with my vendor. In the next 2 weeks, we should be getting ready to install them.
And how many different of these traffic boxes are you going to be installing your art on?
Eight of them. And two of them are actually made by two artists that I mentored, two local artists. They both went to Dillard. And one of them is Mariana. She's in New York right now. She's becoming an artist in the community as well. And one of them is still here. He's a resin artist, David Tamphy, who has like this really interesting style of being very experimental and being random with the work.
Now, hold on a second. Did you just say artist you've mentored?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's amazing because you're not even 20 yet. You've already mentored artists.
Yeah.
What's that like?
Mentorship is actually not like... I actually don't think I'm a leader, as people would think I am. I actually just treat them as my friends. I just try to help them up as much as possible. Because since they're like working as a three-dimensional space, I would be like, hey, you should try, instead of just having like separate kinds of things on each side, it should all be connected into one thing. And I would try my best to give them advice and what things that should be seen, especially when we would go and visit the traffic cabinets, see which places the cars are coming in, where people can view in the most, where the sun hits it, things all of that jazz.
That sounds so cool. When you finally get this done, you're going to post up online for everybody to know where to find these, right?
Yes.
And, you know, just out of curiosity, how many times are you going to be driving by yourself?
I don't really drive. I skateboard.
Okay. Well, you skateboard by them. You want to see your own work, right?
All of them, all the time. I would do it. I would probably skateboard like all the time. I wouldn't even stop.
Ruth Barotti, again, she's a freshman at Broward College, the youngest artist to receive a public art commission from Broward County. And again, she's going to be posting up this new work of hers on these traffic signal boxes. There are going to be 8 of them, and she'll post up and let us know where they're going to be so we could see them. Ruth, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here today. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, if you have season tickets to the Marlins next season, prepare to see a lot of new faces. Dee Gordon is gone. Giancarlo Stanton is gone. And now Marcelo Zuna, likely off to the St. Louis Cardinals. These are all some of the biggest names on the team. All stars. The new owners are tearing this team apart. I spoke with Miami Herald sports writer Andres Fernandez about what's going on with the team. So, Andre, let's see. We've seen Giancarlo Stanton go, Dee Gordon go, Marcelo Zuna now gone. What's going on with the Marlins? They're just giving everybody away?
Yeah, well, they're trading pieces to, you know, to build for the future. I mean, the way they concluded was, you know, the new ownership group that came in needed to clear some payroll because of, you know, they were losing the previous ownership group. Was in the red, losing a lot of money, and they just couldn't sustain the contracts that they had right now, especially the one of Stanton. So their goal is to, you know, start basically from the ground up and really develop the farm system that's been one of the worst in Major League Baseball the last few years. And pretty much their goal, Don Mattingly, the manager, expressed it the best, I think, yesterday at the winter meetings. They want to do this in a way where it's unfortunate that it has to happen this way right now, but they want to make sure that it doesn't happen again the way it has repeatedly in the past under previous ownership. They've picked up a lot of good pieces for the farm system through these trades. Unfortunately, though, it means parting with all-stars. You know, they lose, like you said. You know, Stanton, of course, had become this iconic figure here in South Florida. A lot of people are very upset to see you leave. You lose a talent like that, a guy that, you know, last year finally put it all together and had a historic season. Obviously, that's going to hurt a lot. And then, you know, even Marcelo Zuna finally had his best season. You know, the first couple of years, you saw him progress a little bit. Last year, finally, he put a complete year together and showed his potential. Now he's gone as well. Dee Gordon, a couple of years ago, you know, put it all, you know, had a batting title, stolen base title, gold glove, you name it. Came back from the year where he was put on half a year suspension and had another strong season last year. So it's unfortunate because it's going to get worse before it gets better for them. The next season looks like it could be a very difficult one. There's going to be a lot of new faces, a lot of inexperience, and we don't know yet if they're done, because a lot of teams are still interested in Christian Yelich right now as a potential trade piece. There's other pitchers that are involved in some talks as well. So at this point, the Ozuna deal hasn't even been finalized yet, but it may not be the only one as well as the others.
So earlier this week, Derek Jeter, one of the owners of the team, was seen at the Monday night Dolphins game. And at the same time, there was a big meeting going on in Orlando with owners and GMs, correct?
Yeah, well, he had said originally that he was not going to attend. And you know, a lot has been written about this, but a lot of times most of the time owners don't attend the meetings, you know, with any regularity. But because of the fact that it is Derek Jeter and he is, you know, this symbol, has become the face of the franchise, now coming in, buying the team and that sort of thing, especially at a time like this where a lot of people have questions and seeing the way that they're tearing down this team that everyone has seen, you know, has become so attached to down here. Like, so a lot of people, the fans at least of the Marlins, have seen these big names, you know, and now they're seeing them being, you know, torn away, sent away to other teams. It probably would have been good for him to be there to tell people just basically what Mattingly said yesterday, like give people an idea of the necessity of this, you know, put them at ease to at least as much as possible, let them know this is our goal. This is the long-term plan we see here. We think this team, this franchise can become a winner eventually, but unfortunately it's going to take this painful step at first to get to that point, because right now a lot of people are jaded because they've seen this picture. They've seen this movie before. They saw it with Loria. They saw the way that this team has been torn down. Saw Huizenga back in the 90s, and they're just tired of it. I think there's a lot of upset fans out there that, you know, even if Jeter were to come out and say, you know, all the things that we were talking about, maybe they still wouldn't believe him. But at least I think it would at least give some sort of an idea, a little more of a clear picture to fans, like, hey, we're done. This isn't like it used to be. At least our intent is to make this a long-term winner in Miami.
And how long do they expect fans to wait? How long is it going to take?
Well, that's the thing. That's going to be the hard part because, you know, a lot of these guys are getting look talented, but they're obviously not going to be ready this coming season. In a lot of cases, you know, a lot of cases they might not even be ready till 2019, till 2020 possibly, you know, to see the true development to the point where these guys are going to be major league contributors if they end up being so, and, you know, maybe become the next wave of all-stars that the team could have. So, I mean, that's unfortunately the hard part, you know, in baseball right now, you know, especially when you have a team that doesn't have the large payroll as, you know, say the Yankees or the Red Sox. You know, the formula, the blueprint for this has been done in the majors. You know, the Astros were terrible 4 years ago. Then they built through the system, through prospects, and built the team that won the World Series last year. But it's a painstaking process that takes time. And unfortunately, they've bought a team and come in with a certain amount of money they can spend. And it's in a situation where they're going to come in looking like bad guys because, you know, because of the history before them. Mm-hmm. Everyone is already tired of this type of situation. So as much as they can stress patience, it's going to be hard to get that patience from a lot of the people down here that are tired of seeing that.
Oh, boy. Marlins fans just have a lot of patience, and I'm looking at you, Peter Mertz. That's the program. By the way, that was Andres Fernandez from the Miami Herald. Thanks so much for your time today. Again, that's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. I really appreciate you listening. Have a wonderful weekend. Talk to you on Monday.